Thrilled to see you all. I can't even imagine how much you're going to enjoy this experience tonight. Some of you have met Harlan before. Some of you have heard him on A Vision for You. A Vision for You is a telephone meeting, a registered OA meeting, and he's on frequently. There are some flyers for those of you who are interested in picking one up and joining this amazing meeting. First of all, before I introduce Harlan, I want to mention a little bit about housekeeping. There's water out there. Thank you, Janet, for picking up water. It's on the counter. Thank you very much. The bathrooms, obviously, a couple of them are in the other room. Let us know if you're not comfortable concerning the teacher or lack thereof in the room, please. I think, though, maybe before we introduce Harlan, I'm going to ask Lynn to come forward and lead us in prayer.
My name is Lynn. I'm a compulsive reader.
Hi, Lynn.
My friend Judy asked me to help open with a prayer, and my other friend Mary said, remember a first prayer that we all made when we were standing outside the doors? It goes something like this. Help. 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 Thank you, Mary. So, and this is the one we learned once we got to go back. It goes like this. God.
Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you. Just to remind you, of course, this is the first night of a two-day workshop. Tomorrow we're meeting from 9 to 5 with an hour and a half lunch break. So I'll be here, everybody else will be here, probably by at least 8:45. And look forward to seeing you all then. The only other thing I really want to tell you as far as housekeeping is we are self-supporting, and so we'll just pass the basket tonight for a free will offering. And I guess that's it. Okay. So, Harlan G.
Thank you, Judy. I'm Harlan G. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater, and I'm from Scottsdale, Arizona, via Chicago, as you'll find out as I tell you my story. Very glad to be here. I've never been to Yuma before. I drove to San Diego a number of years ago and drove past it, but it's really a charming... Sorry, we're not okay on that? We need a little more volume or something? Or I think the lights went out in Georgia here.
Let's see, go ahead.
I think the lights went out in Georgia. Oh, there we go. Okay, very good. And wow, I'm impressed. It's a beautiful little, beautiful town. And I'm very, very thrilled to be here. I came to this disease instantly upon being born. I was not one of those people who all of a sudden woke up one day and said, gosh, I've had a couple of babies and I can't get the weight off, or I'm 30 or I'm 40 or I'm 100 or whatever it is, and I have been fixated on food, and eating and weight have been the number one topic of conversation in my life for as far back as anyone can remember. I have very, very vivid memories of my parents. They fought constantly. It was like the Battle of the Bulge in my home all the time. They woke up screaming at each other. They went to bed screaming at each other. It was unbelievable. And they showed their love for one another with pots and pans flying through the air. And they would speak to each other in ways you wouldn't speak to your worst enemy. But there was one time when they would unite and that there would be peace among them, and that is when one would say to the other, my God, what are we going to do about his eating? And that's when they would
But, and they were compulsive overeaters too. My mother died from this disease. My father was a compulsive overeater. And I have vivid memories of being 3 and 4 and 5 years old and people screaming at my mother and father, doctors, dentists, neighbors, the parents of my friends, teachers, screaming at my mother and father, why are you letting him get so fat? Why are you letting him eat candy? Why are you letting him eat chocolate? Why are you letting him eat ice cream? Fill in the blank. And I remember being embarrassed for my mom and dad. My mom and my dad loved me very much. Now, my mom was mentally ill. My mom had 3 distinct personalities. She could be a 3-year-old, she could be a screaming, raving lunatic, or she could be a very together person. You never knew what you were gonna get. You never knew how long it was gonna last. And the personalities could change as quickly as breath comes into her face. She could breathe and just become a different person. And then she could breathe again and just become a different personality. But all the personalities that she had were united on one front. We've got to do something about his eating. My father was 54 when I was born. He was not one generation ahead of me, he was 2. He was older than some of the grandparents of my friends. My father was the sole survivor of religious persecution in Russia when Jews were exterminated wholesale. Long before Hitler came along, the Jews were targets of murder and mayhem. And when my father's family was murdered right in front of him, an extended family of 40 people were obliterated off the face of the earth, and he was the sole survivor. He was the only one that made it alive, and he made it to this country. And he would say to me every day of my life, he would grab my face and he'd say, "Don't ever forget that you're an American, and that's the greatest thing a human being can be, is an American. And I made it to this country so you could be an American." And he'd also say to me, "They're going to kill us. They came to kill me. I got away. One day they're going to come and kill you." And then he'd say, "If they don't kill you, they'll kill your children. Because that's what they do." He said, "One day they will come and kill your children." And this is what I grew up with. This is what I grew up with. And we ate. And we ate. And we ate. And I have vivid memories of going on binges when I was a little boy with my father. We would eat like there was no tomorrow. And when I was 9 years old, I was already like the fattest kid in the school. But when I was 9 years old, 63, I was born in 54. You don't have to do the math. I'm 65 going on 66. I was born in May and I was born in Chicago, Illinois. I went to the doctor. Kennedy was president. Yeah, 63, right. I went to the doctor and the doctor started screaming at my mother in Yiddish and my mother started screaming at him in Yiddish, and next thing I knew I was on very heavy duty amphetamine, and I'm 9 years old and I can feel the temples of my head. I can feel the temples just pounding and pounding, and I could feel the blood surging through my head. And you sleep about 20-30 minutes a month and you don't eat. I mean, food is literally the furthest thing from your mind. But I'm an eater, I'm not a fighter. I'm getting in fist fights at school. I am accused of this now. I'm repeating the same thing like 300 times because the amphetamines are doing crazy things to my head. And when you come down off those pills, if you've never been on amphetamines, heavy duty diet pills, you just crash. I mean, you come down like there's no tomorrow. And I don't know what the problem with my ears was, but people would be talking to me and it sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher. Wah, 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 wah. And I didn't know what the hell they were talking about, and I didn't care. All I could think about was eating and not eating, eating and not eating. And what started happening, which unbeknownst to me, I had an illness of the mind. I'm out of juice here. Oh no, I'm not. I had an illness of the mind and an illness of the body. The emotional buildup that was not getting tamped down by the food was incredible. So, you know, they would tell me when I was a kid, don't eat so much, you'll feel better. Man, they were right. I felt anger better. I felt fear better. I felt like killing myself better. I feel like kicking your ass better. I felt lots of things better. And as those feelings would burst to the surface inside of me, I had nothing to tamp them down because the food worked wonders at letting me have that 9-10 second cushion of peace from the maelstrom of the feelings, of the emotions, of the defects of character. And when you take that away from me, I'm a veritable mess. Now, when I was 10 years old, Marilyn Monroe died, not in Hollywood, and so some of the evils of the diet pills started coming out of Hollywood. Some of the evils of these amphetamines started coming out. And so what they simply did was they switched me from a pink pill 3 times a day to a blue pill 4 times a day with exactly the same results. And I'm on amphetamines at 9 and 10 years old. It's a miracle I didn't become a drug addict. It's a miracle I didn't become, you know, addicted to these amphetamines. And the only addiction that I really knew from was I was addicted to those ice cream sandwiches. I was addicted to that candy, that those Kit Kat bars. Now they've got all my drug pushers running around at this time of year in their green uniforms. They got the Thin Mints, man. Oh, man. I was going to go to the hospital and get a port put in so I could just inject the Thin Mints right into my bloodstream. Oh, my Lord. And they used to come to your house. You know, thank God they don't do that anymore. I'm so happy they don't. But not because of me and my eating disorder, but you don't know whose door you're knocking on. But the bottom line is, when I see them now, I can walk up to them and I can give them $5 or $10 or $20, whatever it is, and I don't want any cookies. And I hear them say to their mom, "Mom, this guy doesn't want any cookies." So I would say to the moms now, I'm just giving it to the troop. What a miracle that is for me. What a miracle. What freedom. That's freedom. And, you know, by the time I was 10 and 11 years old, this disease had emasculated me physically, and this disease had emasculated me emotionally. And this disease took every dream from me that I dared to dream. This disease took every aspiration away from me that I dared to have. I had crushes on girls like anybody else, but I couldn't act on them. I never played spin the bottle. I never played post office. I never did any of those things. I ended up going on my first date with a girl when I was 35 years old. And I went through puberty, but I had no way of expressing myself because I was the fattest kid in the school. I was the fattest kid around. What girl was going to want to kiss me? What girl was going to want to go out with me? What girl was going to want to hold my hand? Didn't happen. And so the loneliness started setting in too, and it affected me psychologically, and it affects me today. It affects me today. And there is a price to pay. There is a price to pay for the food you eat, whether you want to pay that price or you don't. And I find myself in certain areas of intimacy, areas of health, areas of physicality. I have 2 false knees and 2 false hips, and I have AFib that's chronic. AFib is atrial fibrillation of the heart. So that Kentucky Fried Chicken that I ate in 1966, that Kentucky Fried Chicken that I ate in 1967, and those Girl Scout cookies, I'm paying a price for them today. So if you're on the fence and you're not 100% sure you want to dedicate yourself to this program, and you feel that you can identify in with what we're going to talk about tonight and all day tomorrow, I would suggest that 1 year from now, you'll be very glad you surrendered today. And what we're also going to be talking about tomorrow more than today, but we're going to be talking about a little bit today too. We're going to talk about the vast difference between dieting with group support, which is what you see so much of in OA today, and real recovery, real freedom, and what is the difference between the two of them. And we're going to discuss some things that maybe even your sponsors don't talk about with you. And so, as I got to be a teenager, I couldn't dress like the other kids. You know how you hear in the 60s, everybody want to kind of march to their own drummer? Don't believe that. I and everybody around me, we all wanted to be just like everybody else. And in the 60s, if you ever look at Mod Squad or The Man from U.N.C.L.E., or you look at any of the Batman shows, or you look at any of the television programs from that era of time, all the clothes were skin tight and everything was straight. The hair was straight. I grew up with all the Jewish girls, and they would iron their hair because the Jewish girls have frizzy, curly hair. And all the cool girls would go to one girl's house and iron their hair, and all the not so cool girls would go to another girl's house and iron their hair. But anyway, the reason I'm bringing that up is I couldn't wear the straight trimster clothes. I was wearing pants that went out of style before World War II. I was wearing shirts that went out of style during the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration. I couldn't wear the Madras shirts, and I couldn't wear the Nehru shirts, and I couldn't wear the clothes that all the other kids were wearing. And it really affected me to a very great degree. And I became very defeated. I became very defeated, and I would fantasize about death, even at a very young age. I didn't want to live. I saw no point. I knew I couldn't live with the food, and I knew I couldn't live without the food. So what the hell was the point? And I fantasized about suicide all the time. I fantasized about death all the time. And people would say to me, you're going to die if you eat so much. And inside, because I didn't want to say it to them because it makes them mad, I'd say, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. And I almost wasted the one life that God gave me. And as I started to get into my teenage years, my mother and father started dying. They started getting very, very sick. My mom, after I graduated high school, my mom had her leg amputated from diabetes. My mom was on dialysis. My mom was physically sick. My mom was mentally sick. My dad was getting sick. I couldn't go to an away school, an away college, like a lot of my friends could. We didn't have the money for that kind of thing. Number one, I didn't have the grades. I didn't try hard in school. I tested well, but I didn't do very well because I didn't do the homework. How was I going to do homework when, I think we, there we go.
It's on?
Yeah, it's not unidirectional. We got to kind of speak in.
Oh, okay.
That's better.
Okay. I didn't do the homework. I was watching TV and eating. I was watching TV and binging my brains out. How was I supposed to get good grades when I didn't put in the work? Kind of like my early career in OA. I was very upset that I didn't get the results from the work I didn't do. I couldn't understand why it couldn't be this, that I could get, I'm from Chicago. Who do I pay? Who do I get to know? And who's going to give me my OA license so I don't have to do all the work that everybody else has to do? And so I was plunging further and further into the abyss of this disease. When I graduated high school in 1972, I was 335 pounds. By the time I graduated, by the time I was a sophomore in college, I was over 500 pounds. By the time I graduated college, I was over 600 pounds. I remember breaking my ankle in gym class as a junior in high school. This is 1971. And we went to the hospital, and this is when doctors would cast your foot. Now the nurses do it, or the PAs do it, or somebody. The doctors aren't going to sit there and cast your foot anymore. And I remember, as if it was 5 minutes ago, Dr. Bernstein said to my mother over his glasses, he wore his glasses down like this. My mother's name was Virginia. And he walked into the room where they were casting my foot. And he says, Virginia, he isn't going to live past 30. He's 17 years old. He's over 300 pounds. And you're sitting there doing nothing. And my mother started crying. And on the way home from that, we stopped for ice cream. We stopped for ice cream. So life was getting away from me. Money started playing a major role in all this. I had a food habit in the 1970s, not a cocaine habit, not a heroin habit, not a hooker habit, not a whatever habit. My food heaven in the 1970s was about $100 to $150 a day. I was robbing Peter to rob Paul. I lied when the truth would have served me better. I lived in fear constantly of the landlord breaking down my door, wondering where the rent was. I was ashamed to walk the streets. I was open game for every jerk with a wisecrack. People would come up to me and slap my stomach and ask me when the baby hippo was due. On several occasions, people would take food off of my table and they would give it to the busboy and say, he doesn't need this, he's too fat, and I didn't even know them. And I had to pretend that it didn't bother me. I lived in disgrace and shame, and I hated myself because at the end of the day, I knew that I was killing myself, but I couldn't stop. I couldn't live with the food, and I couldn't live without the food. I was emasculated. I smelled like a zoo. Their dirt was so heavy on my neck where the folds of skin were that when I would sweat in the summertime, dirt would come out and it was horrible. My feet couldn't go any closer together than about this. This is about as close together as my feet could get, and I would walk like this. And this is how I would walk. I would waddle like a duck. And that's how I lived. That's how I lived. And this life was not a life. This life was a life of solitude. This was a life of an asexual existence. This was a life when the only time someone touched me that wasn't hostile was when I was getting my hair cut. And I would look forward to getting my hair cut. And then girls started cutting men's hair, which in my childhood was unheard of. And I was in ecstasy because for 20 minutes every other month or so, a girl would be touching my head. Closest thing to sex I had. I had towels shoved between layers of flap. I couldn't wear underwear. I wasn't bathing. I wasn't brushing my teeth. I was writing bad checks to anyone dumb enough to take them. And when I was 22 years old, my mother died. Last conversation she ever had with me while she was lucid was, Harlan, find a way not to eat so much. Now, when I was 24 years old, my father died. Last conversation I had with him, Harlan, find a way not to eat so much. Now, my father died in November of 1978. He led a tortured existence because of the hatred that he saw as a child, the murder and the mayhem that he witnessed firsthand. The sounds of bullets killing a six-month-old never left him. The sounds of his mother and father being shot to death in front of him and his sisters and brothers being murdered in front of him never left him. And I believe strongly that he had great sway with the Lord, because I know he's in heaven because he lived hell on earth. And he died in November of 1978. And on February 2nd, 1979, not long after he passed away, two wonderful friends came into my filthy, dirty, stinking apartment that had pizza boxes and chop suey boxes and bags of candy that were eaten, and boxes and cans and all kinds of garbage and filth. Filth. If I was living in another country, the United States would say, we can't allow people to live that way. We're going to send in help. And I was living right in the United States of America in a place called Chicago, Illinois. The rent wasn't paid, but the convenience store was. The rent wasn't paid, but McDonald's was. If I had money, it had to go to food. I didn't brush my teeth for years. I had one or two pairs of pants, one or two shirts with holes in the underarms, and cigarette burns, and food stains up and down the shirts. And I didn't care because I just wanted to die. On February 2nd, 1979, two wonderful friends, one of which just, I celebrated her 88th birthday on Saturday night past, this past Saturday night. I celebrated her 88th birthday. She lives about two blocks from me in Scottsdale, Arizona. She's like a mother to me, has been for generations. And they came into my home and they took me to my first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous at the Orchard Mental Health Center in Skokie, Illinois. I didn't want to go. I saw no point. I saw no purpose to it. I resented having to be there. And I walked into that room on February 2nd, 1979, and I saw a bunch of people that looked just like you. I was 30 years younger than anybody in that room and 300 pounds fatter than anybody in that room. And I knew I had a problem with food, but I doubted you did. And I couldn't figure out what would motivate you to come to this place when clearly you don't have a problem because you got a new car and you got a house
and you got a husband or a wife. Or you got a microphone that works, or whatever. Well, I couldn't understand what the hell you were doing here, but I knew why I was there, and I didn't understand any of it. And so I couldn't avoid the meetings because I owed them a lot of money. I lied when the truth would have been better, but eventually my lies caught up to me. And they said, we'll give you absolution on your debt while you're going to the meetings. So I ate my way to the meetings and I prayed for a Russian airstrike during the meetings and I would eat my way home. And I would come home and I'd say, wow, fear, false evidence appearing real. And then I would order a pizza. And I'd come home and say, wow, if you always do what you always did, you'll always get what you always got. And then I would order an ice cream cake. I heard a lot of expressions, and I left OA in 1982. I had a beautiful graduation ceremony. Welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order, please? Very well catered by McDonald's. And I came back a couple years later, and I left again, even fatter. And I came back again, and I left again, and I came back, and this time, you put some stuff in my big book that I had never seen before. And what you put in my big book was very, very impactful. The first thing you put in my big book is what I like to call step zero. It's on page 58 of the big book, and it says, if you want what we have, and you are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And I had a wonderful, mean, ornery, cantankerous sponsor. Was not a nice man. He used to poke me in the chest with his big finger. Great big guy. And he'd say to me, are you out of ideas yet, kid? Are you out of ideas yet? And he'd say, because if you're not out of ideas, I'm not going to waste my effing time. Only he would say the golf word. Are you out of ideas yet, kid? And I'd say, yes. And he'd say, what does that mean to you? I'd say, well, if you want what we have, he'd say, what do we have? And I'd say, people that don't eat compulsively. He said, you got that at Weight Watchers. And I couldn't get the answer, so he told me mercifully. What we have here is, hopefully,
We have people that are not eating compulsively, that are compulsive overeaters, that have an illness of the mind and an illness of the body that compels them to eat themselves to death. And while they are not eating, they have been released happily. They are happy in their release from compulsive overeating. That's the difference. See, I don't want to be stark raving abstinent, hanging from the chandelier. I'm an abstinent, I'm hard, and I'm a compulsive overeater, and I have 21 days. I don't want that kind of abstinence. I want to be free. If you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it, are you? Because this is going to be work. This is not a program for people who want it. This is not a program for people who need it. This is a program for people who do it. There is no chapter into wanting, needing, or thinking. But there is a chapter into action. This is an action program. I could have been home sleeping, but Judy said, "Will you come?" And I said, "Okay, I'm not here for you. I hope you get something out of this. I truly do. I worked very hard at crafting this so you can understand and maybe identify in, and hopefully something will be said this weekend that will help you. But I'll tell you what I'm not going to say this weekend. I'm not going to say one thing that's going to help you stay on a diet. I hope I can help you recover from a compulsive overeating disease. I hope I can inspire you to reach higher, but I probably won't say anything this weekend that is going to give you the willpower to put the food down. And I cannot come to your house and knock the food out of your hand. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps." Another thing you put in the book is the thesis line of the big book. It's on page 45. It is the thesis line of this entire book. It says on page 45, "The main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem." And that means we're going to talk about God. We're going to talk about your higher power. Now, I see a lot of sponsors in OA that spend an inordinate amount of time going over food plans and food and food and food and food and food and food. And I see people at conventions, and I bet I see it tomorrow, people taking pictures of their food and sending it to their sponsors. That's all good. That's fine. I'm not knocking that. That's fine. But how much time do you and your sponsor talk about what God really means to you? Do you have an adversarial relationship with your higher power? Do you have an antagonistic relationship with your higher power? Do you have a higher power that you wouldn't trust to walk down a dark alley with? Do you have a higher power that you know in your heart is going to screw you over? That's the kind of stuff that will make you or break you. We have to change those ideas about God. I have to change those ideas about what God is and what God is not. Now, Jimmy Burwell was an alcoholic who came in 1936, and he was an atheist. And he drove this point home of God as you understand God. He opened up the door for countless millions of unborn people to come into these rooms. Jimmy Burwell did that. Abby Thatcher, we're going to talk about that tomorrow. Abby Thatcher says to Bill Wilson in the history of step two, we're going to go through the history of step two tomorrow. He's going to say, "Why don't you choose your own conception of God?" And yet you see so many people in OA today that are dragging a ghost of a God that never worked for them ever. And they're trying to turn their will and life over to a God they never trusted ever. And we're going to talk about what that means tomorrow, to turn your will and your life over to the care and direction of God. We're going to talk about specifically what that means. Now, there's another sentence on page 77 of this book. And it's pure Oxford group. Okay? It says, "Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us." And that means that we are going to have to do service. And what we're going to do tomorrow and what we're going to do tonight and hopefully for the rest of your life is we are going to tear down a lie that you have been told in a way by well-intentioned people that abstinence is the number one thing in your life without exception. False. False. Abstinence is definitely an integral part of my life, but it is not the most important thing in my life without exception. Working with others is the most important thing in my life without exception. For if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through service and self-sacrifice for others, he will surely drink again, and for us to drink is to die, and faith will be dead indeed, and with us it is just like that. That means that you will teach this incessantly to others or you will die in the disease. You want me to say that again? Because there's people in this room that may not be sponsors. Did you check out everybody before I came? Like I asked you to? I'm going to say this again, and you probably don't want to listen to this. Don't remember this. Discard this information. You will teach this incessantly to others every day of your life, or you will die in the disease. The only way for you to keep this is to teach it to others. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through service and self-sacrifice for others, he will surely drink again, and with us to drink is to die. With us it is just like death, and faith will be dead indeed. Faith without works was dead, he said. And when he said he's talking about Ebby Thatcher, who we're going to talk about a lot tomorrow morning. Now, there's one other thing that struck me in this book that's very important, and I want to get to the doctor's opinion. And you'll learn a little bit more about me as the weekend goes on. And it's in the foreword to the second edition. In the foreword to the second edition on page XX, it says, of 100 who came in to Alcoholics Anonymous, 50% got sober at once. 25% of the remaining 50 came back and got sober. And of the other 25%, they showed marked improvement. Now that's 75% recovery. Now, I have done big book retreats like we're having this afternoon, as far east as Jerusalem, Israel, as far west as San Diego, California, Los Angeles, California, as far north as Alberta, Canada, as far south as Mobile, Alabama, as far east as Boston, and most points in between. We can't talk about 75% recovery. Are you kidding me? In OA? No way. They can't even talk about that in AA. Don't let them lie to you and tell you that they can't. We can't talk about 10% recovery in OA. We can't talk about 5% recovery in OA. We're lucky if we're coming in and recovering at 1.5 to 2%. Why? Because we're getting away from pure, uncut message. And if you're listening on the tape, I'm holding in my hand one of the most important pieces of spiritual literature that the world has ever seen. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. God wrote this book. Bill Wilson was 43 years old when this book was scribed, with 3.5 years of sobriety. I have 21 years of abstinence. I'm lucky I can knock out a coherent text message. This is one of the greatest pieces of spiritual literature ever written. And is considered by most experts one of three things that will endure from the 20th century in the thousands and thousands and thousands of years that are yet to come. Long after we're gone, there are three events: the Wright brothers' flight, the airplane age, the computer / atomic age, and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. These are the three things that are going to endure in the thousands and thousands and thousands of years into the future. God wrote this book. Now, we may never get back to 75%. saying that we can get back to it is crazy because we were never there. But we can do better than we are doing. And specifically, that means we're going to have to take it upon ourselves to spread the word and to be an example of what this program can do. We have to stop waiting for somebody else. We have to stop waiting for someone else to do it. You have your unique message. We can do better than what we're doing. We also, and this is a commentary, this is just my opinion, we also have not done the job in the Black community. We have not done the job in the Hispanic community. We have not done the job in the gay community. We have not done the job in the Native American community. We will be better when we are different. We will be stronger when we are different. You would get the impression at most of these that all the people afflicted with this disease are white. And that is simply not the case. We must do a better job of reaching out. And if it's going to be, it starts with me. We must do a better job. We will be stronger, better, when we are different. It's been a long journey. It's been a journey that has been fraught with heartbreak and disappointment. I got divorced in recovery. I have a 25-year-old, doesn't speak to me, in recovery. I've had relationship challenges in recovery. I've been lonely to the point of tears in recovery. But I have seen miracles. Now, I'm not just talking about the Cubs winning the World Series, which is amazing. I'm not just talking about a sunset or a sunrise or seeing a moose in Alaska in the wild. I wasn't at the zoo. I'm not talking about that. Those are wonderful things. Do you know what I've seen? I've seen compulsive overeaters with an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind not eating compulsively and doing so happily. There's no greater miracle than that. There's no greater miracle than that. And as I look out at this room, I see lots of miracles. You are a miracle that you're here. Many wanted to come, but were too scared to come. They wouldn't allow themselves to come here. There were people that told you they wanted to come, but they couldn't do it. But you're here. You're here. Now, I have 21 years of abstinence, and I've lost a little over 500 pounds. You know, for centuries, going back all the way to the Old Testament, Solomon, King Solomon of Israel, King Solomon believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. In 1640s in England, the 1640s, there was a doctor named Dr. Trotter. Dr. Trotter wrote a paper in 1640, and he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. In 1790, there was a man who wrote a paper in which he believed that alcoholism was indeed an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it, and his name was Dr. Benjamin Rush. He was the first Surgeon General of the United States. He was appointed by President George Washington. And he wrote a paper in 1790, and he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but of course, he couldn't prove it. He had no cure for it. If you ever look at a booklet of the speeches of Abraham Lincoln, the famous speeches, you'll come across a speech in 1848 that he gave as a young congressman from Illinois. He gave a speech to the Washingtonians. The Washingtonians were a group of people formed in Baltimore, Maryland, and they were dedicated to keeping each other sober, but they got embroiled in other issues of slavery and whether Texas should be admitted as a free state or a slave state. And they got embroiled in lots and lots of outside issues, and they faded quickly. And Abraham Lincoln said, this is brilliant, listen to what he said, liquor seems to do something for you fellas that it doesn't seem to do for folks like me. He didn't say it does something to you fellas. He said it does something for you fellas. Because food does something for me that nothing else does. It is amazing, and it is unbelievable what it does for me. It gives me a sense of ease and comfort that nothing else does except the working of the steps. Now, in the 1920s, in New York, the largest and most famous hospital for the treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction, they did have drug addiction then, they had maybe some different drugs than what you might take today, but they absolutely had drug addiction. They had laudanum, and they had heroin, and they had all kinds of stuff back then, too. And in 1901, Charlie Towns started a hospital called the Towns Hospital. And in the 1920s, he was friends with a guy by the name of William Duncan Silkworth, who was a neurologist, unconcerned about alcoholism at all. Unconcerned. And William Duncan Silkworth was a little over-invested in the stock market. And on Black Tuesday, October 29th, 1929, Silky lost everything he had when the stock market crashed and the Great Depression was on. Now, for some of you who don't have a picture of the Depression, I'm not going to go off and tell you the history of it or any of that. I'm just going to paint a little picture for you. A number of years ago, when we had an unemployment rate of about 15%, people were marching on Washington, quite angry too, right? You had an unemployment rate of 15%. In 1929, after October the 29th, unemployment among whites was 60%. Unemployment in minorities was 95 to 100%. There were no jobs. There was no money. And Silkworth went to work at the Towns Hospital for $35 a week. And Charlie Towns made him the medical director of the hospital. And from 1929, November of 29 until 1934, Charlie Towns observed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people coming into the Towns Hospital in deplorable condition from drinking and drugs. And some of these guys, now most of them were men, not all of them, but most of them were men. They would fix them up, and they would tend to their medical needs, and these guys would leave, and about 90% of them never came back. They were slapped on the hand, they got in trouble with alcohol, and they were done. They were done. About 10% of these dudes would go out,
and come in,
and go out,
and come in,
and go out and come in, and every time they came back, they were remarkably and progressively worse. And Charlie Towns did the best that he could. But Silkworth, he observed these guys and he started to formulate a theory, an opinion, if you will, about these men. Something that he saw in them and something that he just knew. He couldn't prove it, but he decided that this was what was going on, and it turned out that he was right. What did he see in these people? What did he view in these people? He viewed an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind, coupled with its sidekick, the mental blank spot. Let's take a look at page XXV in the fourth edition. If you have a big book, crack it open. If you don't, use your phone. There's a big book in your phone. You can download an app called Big Book. And you can follow along if you care to. If not, just listen. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter, to whom it may concern. Thank you. I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. Now, hopeless is a good thing, because hopeless can mean that you're out of ideas. Are you out of ideas? I sure as hell hope so. Because if you've got that idea of how you're going to be abstinent 6 days a week and eat everything you want on your birthday, or you've got that idea that you're going to only overeat when there's a day with a Y in it, or you're going to overeat on whatever day, we can't really help you. We can't really help you. You have to be out of ideas. And hopeless is maybe not a bad thing here, because hopeless can mean that you're at the bottom. There was a famous Alcoholics Anonymous speaker, he's been dead a long time. His name was Joe Leaf. Joe was called Wino Joe. There's not a lot of recordings of Wino Joe because he was very profane. Every other word out of his mouth was a dirty golf word. And when he spoke in Chicago, there's a sign in the Lincoln Park Alano Club, lack of profanity will offend no one. But one of the things that Wino Joe used to say, he'd say, we don't need all these questions in AA about all this stuff. I'll tell you if you're an alcoholic. He'd say, have you ever been arrested for drunken disorderly while in jail? If you are, you're probably an alcoholic. And he'd say, have you ever been arrested for drunk driving from the back seat of somebody else's car? If you have been, then you're probably an alcoholic. And he'd see a wino, he'd get himself a belly of that wine, and he'd go out in Texas and lay out in those cotton fields drunk, and he'd say, if you've ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned, then you're probably an alcoholic. Those are the only questions you really need. But Wino Joe said something else that was pretty profound. You know what he said? He said, how do you know you're at the bottom of a hole? When you stop digging. When you stop digging. And that's what he said. And Wino Joe was right. If you feel like you're hopeless, stop digging. Start working the steps.
Start working the steps. You can begin today. You can begin from where you are. There's no rules here. There's no rules. There's no anything. You can recover. We'll welcome you with open arms. Let's continue. In the course of his third treatment, we're going to learn tomorrow that Bill is going to be hospitalized for his alcoholism three times. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery.
The Oxford group, we're going to explain that tomorrow.
As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions
to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others.
This has become.
Should I just turn?
Okay. Are you sure this is working the way it's working?
No.
This has become the basis
of a rapidly growing fellowship with these men and their families. This man and over 100 others
appear to have recovered.
No,
and that's
without that.
Oh.
So much less than normal.
All right. I'll teach you a Yiddish word. Mishadas, craziness. So we don't have to do that. Okay.
Actually, that's working beautifully
right now. Right now, that's perfect. Okay. That seems to be good. All right. That seems to be. See, less is more. See. Okay. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. The paying ways didn't work for you. The gyms didn't work for you. The therapists didn't work for you. Now, I'm not knocking therapy. I think therapy is wonderful. Bill Wilson was in therapy his whole life. But when it comes to your eating disorder, it didn't work, or you wouldn't be sitting here. See, the average person has to spend $100,000 on dreck, which is a Yiddish word for poo-poo. You have to spend $100,000 on dreck before you'll come in here. You have to buy the clothes that you'll never wear. You have to buy the clothes that really didn't fit the day you bought them, and you convinced yourself you were going to get into those clothes, but you never did, and then you gave them away. You had to buy the bike because you needed a place to store your books, and you needed a place to dry your t-shirts, so you bought an exercise bike, or you bought an elliptical, or you bought a treadmill, because you needed a place to store books, and you needed a place to store certain garments. And you needed to join the gym. You needed to do that and never go. Or if you did go, it didn't cure you. Some people had the urine of pregnant women shot up their keister. That was big when I first came in. People were going to the doctor and paying money, big money, to have the urine of pregnant women shot up their butt. And when I was young in program, not only were a lot of people on the diet pills, but they also went to acupuncturists. Japanese stuff was real huge at that time. And they'd get these staples put in their ears, and they would pull them. And they, like Carol Burnett used to do at the end of her show, and it didn't work either. And there's all manner of craziness. You just watch any late night television program, you're going to see pills and supplements and infomercials on how if you drink the urine of a cod, you're never going to eat this way again. You're going to be magically healthy, and you know everything's going to be groovy. Everything's going to be beautiful. You're going to want to buy the World of Coke, and you're going to want to sing Kumbaya at the fire, and everybody's going to be beautiful. But it doesn't work for people like us. Doesn't work for people like us. So that these other methods failed completely. The facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth in the inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Now, you take for granted that you have William Duncan Silkworth's name in here. But what some of you don't know is, maybe not, for the first 10 printings of this book, from 1939, April 10, 39, until 1950, he wouldn't allow his name to be in here. Bill Wilson asked him to write this, and he said, I will write this for you under one condition. Don't you dare put my name in there. These are untested, unproven theories. And if you put my name in there, they're going to run me out of the medical profession. And in 1949, Harry Tebow, who was on the original board of Alcoholics Anonymous, he was a non-alcoholic trustee. They had non-alcoholics on the board at that time. Harry Tebow was also Bill Wilson's psychiatrist. He also, Marty Mann, women suffer too. He knew her. And Harry Tebow wrote a paper in 1949, was published in the American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association, accepted alcoholism as an illness. And Silky said to Bill, okay, you can put my name in there now. And Silkworth died in 51. But he remains to this day our great medical benefactor. And there will never be anything short of this statement. Without him, there is no program. There's nothing to build on. There's nothing. We walk in here on the shoulders of giants, and among those giants is Dr. Silkworth. You walk in here on the shoulders of Ebby and Bill and Jimmy Burwell and Fitzmaille and Hank Parkhurst. You walk in here on the shoulders of Clarence Snyder and Dr. Bob. You walk in here on the shoulders of Archie Throwbridge and Earl Treat, and you walk in here on the shoulders of Sylvia Kaufman and Roseanne S. And you walk in here on the shoulders of A.G. Ainsworth. If you don't know who these people are, I'm going to do the best I can to make sure you know who they are before we leave tomorrow. You owe. You owe. Don't you sit here and go home and change nothing. Don't you disgrace this by going home and not recovering. You want to show people how great this was? Recover, recover, recover. Don't you dare go home and not sponsor. Don't you dare go home and not do service. You owe. And one of the guys you owe is Dr. William Duncan Silkworth. The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. Must. That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. Now you have to understand that for thousands and thousands of years, this was considered a disease of weak will, lack of willpower, lack of character, insanity, stupidity, all the things that you've been told your whole life that are not true. Some of you have great willpower. Some of you have plenty of character. Some of you have done remarkable things with your life. But because you couldn't stay out of the food, you couldn't think that you had these things because existentially you became wrong all over the place. Because you were fat, you were automatically discredited. And the truth of the matter is, you have a disease and it's not your fault. You didn't cause it, you can't cure it, and you can't control it. It's not your fault. 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 It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. This is the very first time in thousands and thousands and thousands of years that a physical factor is being considered. It was never considered before. Never. Never. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol, allergy, interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. And this allergy, when they're talking about explaining things when you can't account for them, is why you intended to eat one cookie and you ate the whole box and another box and another box. Why could you not stop when other people could? Why were you not able to do what you saw going on around you? And what you saw going on around you were people eating moderately, but you could not. Because of this physical factor, that once the food is inside of you, you cannot be held responsible for how much you're going to eat. You have a physical allergy to certain foods and ingredients. And if they are ingested, they are going to set off that craving every time. Let's continue. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he then has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. In other words, what is he saying for the first of three times? Put down the food. Put down the food. Put it down. Now, you cannot work the steps successfully while you're eating. It doesn't work that way. Don't let anybody tell you that it does. It does not. He's going to tell us that two more times. The subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was therefore a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. Now the next paragraph is a paragraph written by Silkworth, who is a scientist and a doctor. Let's take a look at the next paragraph twice. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. I'm going to read the paragraph again. Now keep in mind that Silkworth was a doctor, and he's a scientist, he's a clinician. Let's read the paragraph again. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of spiritual awakening was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond medicine's conception. What with medicine's ultra-modern standards, our medicine's scientific approach to everything, medicine is perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside our medical knowledge. He's confessing for the first of two times that as the alcoholic is powerless over alcohol, he, the doctor, is powerless over the alcoholic. There is nothing he can do for you. Nothing. He's watching you die. And doctors have been watching us die for a very, very long time. Doctors would love to help us. They know what's wrong with us. They can't help you. Because you can go out that door and eat whatever the heck you want to eat, and there's nothing they can do. They can't lock you up. They can't. What are they supposed to do? They are as powerless over us as we are over food. I hope that second reading amplified that meaning for you just a little bit. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Now, when they say here with some misgiving they consented, they were not too thrilled that Bill Wilson was getting further with their patients than they were. Bill is not a psychologist. Bill was not a doctor. He was not a counselor. And he was able to speak the language of the heart to these men. And they were not thrilled that he was doing that either. Because these people are paying for professional help, and they're getting help from a guy that is not registered and not certified and not official. And they were concerned. But they saw that he was reaching some of the patients that they were unable to reach. And among those patients is going to come Hank Parkhurst, Fitzmaio, Jimmy Burwell, some of these guys that came out of the original New York group. And that's what Silkworth is going to see. And these guys were pretty damn hopeless. If it wasn't for Hank Parkhurst, there is no book. Now, he died drunk. He didn't stay sober. Most of the guys who wrote the stories in the first edition died drunk, and that's too bad. But if it wasn't for these guys, no book, no program, no me, no you. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. What's he telling you there? Put down the food. Put down the food. Put down the food. That's the second of three times he's going to tell you that. You cannot continue eating and hope that somehow you're going to have a spiritual awakening. Because if you're getting the effect from the food, you don't need the effect from the steps. You already feel better. You already feel just fine. You don't need that. So nothing's going to happen. We believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. What he's saying there is, once you take certain foods, sugar, white flour, for me, I don't know what it is for you, certain fats, certain fried foods, certain things like that, it's going to set that craving up every single time. And I can't, you know what, when you're dancing with a gorilla, you know when you're done? When the gorilla says you're done. When I eat French fries, I'm done when the French fries say I'm done. It's like dancing with a gorilla. You're done when the gorilla says you're done. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Frothy means with no substance, like the head of a beer. There's no substance to it. Frothy emotional appeal, bribing us, browbeating us, nagging us, it's not going to do any good. It just doesn't do any good. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. You speak the language of the heart. You understand the language of the heart. This is the only group of people here in Yuma that has experienced recovery. And you are the only group of people in Yuma that have experienced this disease. You are uniquely qualified to pass this word to the still sick and suffering. That means we have a job to do. God's got a job for me, and he's got a job for you. I'm not going to be around much longer. Another 20 years, 25 years, I'm 65 years old. How much time do I have? Maybe one day you need to be up here. Maybe one day you need to be at the birthday. Maybe one day you need to be at the convention or the retreat leading it. Maybe the world needs to hear your message. In order for the message to be carried, it must have depth and weight. Now, we concentrate a lot of time and money and effort on newcomers. That's good work, and we should do that. That's good. We have people dying in the meetings that are sitting beside us now that are dying from their untreated food addiction, and we're hugging them to death. We're hugging them to death. It's time to gently but lovingly say, I'm here for you. I've struggled too. Can I help? If they don't want your help, that's fine. Sometimes it takes a while for that idea to sink through the ego, but that doesn't mean we can't offer. It doesn't mean we have to watch them die. You don't have to be brutal. You don't have to be mean. You don't have to be cruel. You can be loving, but firm. I'm here for you. I see you struggling. Is there anything I can do to help you? And what are the three things you can do for the still suffering person? Recover, recover, and recover. Show them. I know some of you are going to ask in the Q&A tomorrow, what can I do for my child, my daughter, my mother, my father, my aunt, my uncle, my turtle, my dog? Here's what you can do for the still suffering person. Recover, recover, and recover. Those are the three things you can do. Let them see what this program is doing for you. They'll see it. Recover. If any feel as psychiatrists directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental. Let them stand with us a while on the firing line, see the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Now the next sentence is so vital, so important, that it is the cornerstone of everything that we are going to build. Without the next paragraph, there is no program. There's no reason for it. Let's see what that paragraph is, and we'll pull it apart a little bit, and then we'll move on. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. Now, wait a minute here. I want you to pay attention. Food was never the problem. Never. If you are a compulsive overeater, food was the solution to the problem. Food is not the problem. See, we take a look at a person who's obese, or we take a look at a person who's severely anorexic or bulimic, and we attack what we see, and we say, well, we have to control the amount of food going in them. No. You're working on a symptom there. Food was never the problem. Food was the solution to the problem. Now, if food is the solution to the problem, what's the problem? The problem is the buildup of everyday, normal, human emotion. Now, all human beings have anger, happiness, fear, lust, satisfaction, jealousy, regret, remorse. All human beings have these emotions. Dogs have emotions. We had German Shepherds for years, purebred German Shepherds. I could look at my German Shepherds. They're gone now. I don't have them anymore. They're dead. I could look at them and I know when they're happy, I know when they're angry, and I know when they're jealous, and I know when they're sad, and I know when they're ashamed of themselves. I can look at them and tell you. And in a normal person's mind, when they have these emotions, there is no stirring in their mind that says, eat some cookies. Because they are okay with these emotions, or they can use walking around the block as a solution, or playing with the dog, or making love, or having a drink, or knocking out a bucket of balls, or going for a bike ride. They're good. And you see them every day. But we can't do that. Because these emotions are so painful that the brain says, eat some ice cream. And we say no, and the brain says, eat the damn ice cream. And we eat the ice cream because it's a step up from where we are. We cannot stand the pain any longer. And we eat that ice cream in search of relief from that untenable, searing, unrelenting, debilitating, all-encompassing torture of not eating. And that's why we eat. because the pain of not eating is too much to bear. That's why diets don't work for people like us. Because every day you get older, and your body and you are less able to fend off the effects of this illness. Every day you wake up, your disease gets worse because the disease is powerful, progressive, and fatal. And every day you get up, things are changing. And as they change, they're going to scare you or piss you off. And when those defects of character are awakened and rattled, you are going to dive headfirst into an ice cream sandwich. And for about 9 seconds, you're going to feel like the world is your little oyster. You're going to feel fantastic. Oh, food. Oh, it's almost like a psychotic, delusional trip through the world. Because food does something for me, not to me, for me, that it does not do for others. I thought it did. I found out I was wrong. Food changes my perception of reality. It changes instantly my perception of reality, and it makes the world a beautiful place. Of myself, I'm scared of you. It does not seem to me that my quivering, broken insides match up with your seemingly together outsides. And I take that shortcut to misery through the junction of comparison. The shortcut to misery is through comparison. And when do I compare? When things are not going well for me. I don't compare when things are going well for me. I compare when things are not going well for me. And food becomes a step up from where how I feel. And I eat this food in search of relief from this pain. And I get it for 9 seconds. And then what happens? Now I've triggered the physical allergy. And in triggering that physical allergy, now I cannot stop. And if I cannot stop eating once I've started, and I cannot keep from eating now that I want to, I am powerless over food, and my life is unmanageable. Mm-hmm. It begs the question, what's a fella to do? Well, if I am powerless in step one, then I'm going to find that power in step two. And the art, the action of bringing that power into the equation is simply called recovery. And that's what this is all about, Charlie Brown. This is about substituting the effect of the steps for the effect of the food. One has death-defying side effects, and one has a lifetime of miracles. Now, I told you before about all the things that have happened to me in recovery. But the miracles I've seen are unbelievable. Oh, the places I've gone and the people that I've met. Some of you here in Yuma will be with me the rest of my life. Whether I'm keeping in touch with you or not, I will never forget your faces. I will never forget the interaction we had at dinner or the interaction we're going to have at lunch and dinner tomorrow. I will never forget it. And I will never forget that I was here. And this will be yet another place that God brought me to visit. You've touched me permanently and positively and wonderfully. And you are a gift in my life. That's part of what this is to the people. Because when God can't come, he sends people. People like you. Gods with skin. And so I hope you get something out of this weekend. But I assure you, I will. I will. So we see these people eating with impunity, and what impunity means is they're not getting punished. Punis, the same root word of punish is the same word of impunity, punish. We see them eating and it doesn't seem to bother them or affect them, but it bothers us and it affects us. Because we have an illness of the mind and we have an illness of the body. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. What are the rules? The rules are the steps. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, "Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me." Faced with this problem, the doctor is honest with himself. He must sometimes feel his own inadequacy, although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate means total, of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain day favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape, they were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. So these guys had a business meeting and they got scared, they got selfish, they got angry, they got jealous, they got something, and they used liquor to calm down. And they, because of the physical allergy, they couldn't control the amount they were drinking. And on the previous page in that other paragraph I read, Silkworth is admitting again that he is as powerless over the alcoholic as the alcoholic is over alcohol. That he cannot help you. He can point out what's wrong. He knew what was wrong with Bill Wilson, but he couldn't help him. Couldn't help him. Let's continue. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. And there are people in your groups here in Yuma that are dead. And there are more people at your groups here that are going to die in this disease. Now, we're all going to die. And I want to tell you a story. When I was a young boy, growing up in the neighborhood that I grew up in, most of the adults that I knew, not all, but most of the adults that I knew were survivors of the concentration camps in Europe. They were survivors of the Holocaust, the greatest crime ever perpetrated against humanity in its entire history. And these tattooed people, they all had the tattoos on their left arm, would grab my face and say, "Live until you die. Live until you die." And what that means is maximize your life. Death is going to come to us all. There's no reason you can't recover in the one life you have. This is not a dress rehearsal. Are you working with the same sponsor you've been working with for years and you've never really recovered? What are you afraid of? Why are you afraid to make a change? Are you afraid of hurting somebody's feelings? This isn't about that. This is about living instead of dying. Because there's no life in the food for me. I don't know how it is for you, but there's no life for me in the food. Life in the food is death. Life in the food is an existence of dreck, of crap. Live until you die. Make some changes if you're not going in the right direction. Do what it takes to recover. This is not a dress rehearsal. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. Decision is step three. Step three is a decision and a a beginning. There is the type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink, step one. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are the types entirely normal in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. What's Dr. Silver telling you after the third or three times? Put down the food. Put the food down. Now, put it down. That's what he's telling us. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the great opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. The first one we're going to read is about Hank Parkhurst, and the next one will be about Fitzmail. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had been partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life, was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. The transformation in Hank was unbelievable. He was an alcoholic who was free from the alcohol. Now, he died drunk, but at the writing of this, he was doing good. Fitzmail, next. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and decided his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort, unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, spiritual awakening, and we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. In other words, he started working the steps. I see him now, he has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. Fitz would die of cancer, but he wouldn't die drunk, he would die sober. He would die sober in 1943. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and perhaps he came to scoff. He may remain to pray. William D. Silkworth, M.D. Now, the depth at which you accept the doctor's opinion is going to mark the urgency with which you will work the rest of the steps. That's vital for you to remember. The depth at which you accept the doctor's opinion will mark the urgency with which you will work the rest of the steps. Now, I will take 3 questions. I'm dead tired. It took a long time to drive here today. I'm tired. Now, I do not take food questions. No food questions. I am not a nutritionist. I am not a dietitian. I'm not a doctor. I do not know what you should be eating. Take that to somebody who does know. And my food plan should not be of any interest to you at all whatsoever. So I do not take food questions. If you do not have a food question, I'll take three of them. Three questions. Anybody? Yes.
How does hereditary play into this?
I think it has a definite factor, but I think you either have this or you don't. I think you either have it or you don't. You know, there's families where there's twins, one has it, one doesn't. There's families where there's lots of kids, some do, some don't. So yeah, I think it's a factor, but some have it, some don't. Yes?
We talk about allergies with alcoholism, but there's a gene, you can have a genetic predisposition mm-hmm. for alcoholism.
Outside issue, I don't know. I just know the physical allergy and I know the mental twist as described in the big book. Anything regarding genetics or anything is outside the scope of what I know. I really don't know. Only once? Yes.
Have you had a profound spiritual experience?
Yes, I've had a profound spiritual awakening. I have not had a profound spiritual experience. I've had a slow developing growth of a spiritual awakening. But no, I have not had that sudden, spectacular white light experience that Bill had, no. But I've had a spiritual awakening. Yeah. I'll take one more because these are short. I'll take one more. Nope. Okay, see you tomorrow.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
As you know, this is a big book study, and you probably have noticed Anne over in the corner there. And she has big books for sale at our cost. You know, we make no money whatsoever, of course, on them. And they are, some of them are just the first 164 pages, some of them are big study books, some of them are large print books. Please avail yourselves of them, or if you don't have a big book already, if you do, please bring it tomorrow.
Thank you.
Yes. 10 years. 10 years.